Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Golf Smarter Premium number 531, published on March 15, 2016. Forgiving drivers, fairway woods, and hybrids designed for amateur golfers. By the Pope of Slope, Dean Knuth.
This is Golf Smarter Premium. Here's your host, Fred Green.
Welcome to the Golf Smarter Podcast, Dean.
Thank you.
It is great to get you on the show. We've had technical difficulties. It took us, I don't know, an hour the other day to get it figured out, and then an hour this morning. But we're here, yeah. We're live, we're on Blab, and I really appreciate you taking time out of your vacation to talk to me.
Thank you.
I've been thinking about this conversation a lot, and first we should, you know, introduce the audience to who you are. You are currently developing golf clubs, hybrids, drivers called High Heat and Fairway Woods. But previously you were with the USGA for many years, and you are known as the Pope of Slope because you created the rating and slope system. And you were also the senior director of handicapping in GHIN GIN and the Green Section Administration for a long time, correct?
I was there 16 years and started in handicapping and moved on to starting up GIN with Frank Thomas. In fact, my GIN number is 007.
Is it really?
Yeah.
That is so awesome. Here's what I'd like to talk about today. First, I'd like to talk about you being the Pope of Slope and to get a layman's explanation of what rating and slope is and how to take advantage of it. Then I'd like to talk about the state of the industry from your perspective. And again, we're looking at it not through a PGA Tour's eyes, but we're looking at it through an amateur golfer's eyes. So I'd like to know what your thoughts are on the state of the industry, and then your thoughts on state of the game, and then we'll get into the high heat clubs that you're creating.
Sounds good.
Okay, great. So I know personally, when I go out to play a round of golf for a golf course I've not played before, and I'll be with friends or whoever, and they'll go, oh, okay, this course is 6,800 yards. We should play from the white tees. And I'm like, I don't think that the yardage is what we should be looking at, because you could have really tough, you know, short game here, and it'll make it a much harder course. Why don't we look at the rating and slope? And nobody understands that when I come across it. And I always look for, if it's between like a 128 to a 132 on the slope, then I'm comfortable playing that tee. That's the tee that I'll be focused on.
Right. So, and I agree with that.
Excellent. Why? What is this?
Well, high slope is not necessarily a good thing. I mean, there are golf courses that can go all the way up to 155. That's the maximum USGA slope rating.
Okay.
And it's not exact, but approximately, you can use that number to estimate how fast scores go up as the handicaps go up. So if it's a 150 slope golf course, the scores go up almost 1.5 shots per stroke increase in handicap. So the difference between a 10 and a 20 is not 10 shots, it's almost 15 shots. And that's not exactly right, because there's a standard number of 113 that's involved in it, but it's a good way of thinking of it. So what you'd like to do is play a golf course that's in the area of 120 to 128, somewhere around there. And if you have to move up and tees, then you're gonna have a lot more fun. Unless you're a scratch golfer, it doesn't matter what the slope rating is, really.
Well, yeah, if you scratch call it, yeah, you're looking at the rating then, right?
Correct, yeah.
Okay,
so there are two numbers. Mm-hmm. So the course rating is the expected score of a scratch golfer, better half of the time. The slope rating is a way to track how fast scores go up as handicaps go up.
That's the part I don't understand. And I'm sorry, I'm not a math guy. So
So
can we make that simpler?
Yeah.
Is that possible?
Possibly. Well, first off, it'd probably be good to say what slope means, where it came from. And if you were to plot scores versus handicaps on any golf course or any sets of tees, the rate of the increase has the speed is the rate at which scores go up as handicaps go up. Well, plot a line, and that line is the slope of the golf course.
And it's the angle of that line?
It's the angle of that line. Yeah, that's what it is. So standard, a theoretical average slope in America is 113, which means that scores go up at the rate of 1.13 strokes for each stroke increase. In handicap. Yeah. And that's theoretically the average. Now, as it turned out, in areas like, well, most metropolitan areas in America, the average slope ratings are higher than that. That 113 might be right in mid-America someplace. So it turned out that the average slope is around 118 nationwide. So, and again, they go up to 155. Pine Valley near Philadelphia is near the extreme. And originally, when I designed it, it was 1.32 had been the slope. But I moved the decimal point right 2 points to make it like IQs, easier to understand for people. So 132 could be the slope rating. And it just means that it's in comparison to the scratch golfer, starting there, what score would the bogey golfer shoot in comparison? And it's a way to predict that. And so by being able to predict that, you can actually determine how many strokes you need at a golf course. Because if you go to a golf course with a high slope rating, you need more strokes than you do on a golf course that's a lower slope rating. And again, it doesn't matter if you're scratch golf or you're zero everywhere.
Right. Okay. So now you had me for a moment and then you lost me again. So when you talked about the bogey golfer, that's the score he would shoot. No.
Yeah. Yeah. No, the bogey golfer is how I arrived at a slope rating. So we rated a golf course for the scratch golfer.
Mm-hmm.
And then we rated the golf course for the bogey golfer, which is somebody that's in the range of 17 to 20 handicap. That's a bogey golfer. He shoots bogeys most of the time when he plays. And so a rate of the course for the bogey golfer, and those 2 points produce the steepness of the line, which produces the slope rating of the golf course. And you can actually work out yourself how many strokes you're going to get on a golf course just by knowing what your handicap index is, which is a decimal number, which is something that we had to create when we implemented the system in the first place, and then just multiply the ratio of the slope rating that says on the scorecard divided by 113, and if you multiply that by the handicap index and round it off 0.5 rounds up, that is actually the number of strokes you get on for those sets of tees. I usually don't have to do that because either the computer will tell you or there's a table that will tell you. But that's the way the calculation's made.
So it shouldn't, on a course that's a par 72, wouldn't a bogey golfer shoot 90? Isn't that one over for every hole?
No. Well, again, if it's a high slope rating, they're going to shoot higher than 90. But the par has nothing to do with anything. You can have really easy, a really easy golf course that's par 72. You can have a very difficult golf course, like a U.S. Open course that's par 72. And so par is pretty much irrelevant. The number that counts is the course rating, which is the number that the expert golfer is expected to score. So so you'd take, if you really want to predict a score, you'd take your course handicap, whatever your course handicap is based on slope rating. And let's say that your course handicap is 22. And you'd add that number to the course rating, and that would be what you're expected to score. So if the course rating is 70,
I see, and
it's 22, then your expected score would be 92. If your course handicap, if your course handicap is 16, let's say, and the course rating is 70, then 16 plus 70 is 86.
86.
Yeah. So that's how you figure out what you should score. And it's going to vary by tee. I mean, your course handicap goes down when you play shorter tees. It goes up when you play higher tees, you know, higher rated tees, higher slope rated tees. And the course rating goes up too. So your expected score from the back tees, if the course rating were as high as, let's say, 76, and from the back tees, your course handicap went up to 24, then the expected score is 76 plus 24.
So when you devised this at the USGA, I'm sure this just wasn't you, that there was a committee of people who were putting this together and work and developing this. Fair assumption?
No, actually, there was a handicap research team, but they did other things. My project was course rating and slope rating. Uh-huh. And it all started for me in the U.S. Navy. I was active duty in the Navy. I graduated from the Naval Academy, and they sent me to graduate school at Monterey, California. So I was there 2.5 years to develop a master's degree, systems technology, systems engineering. And I had a course called, in 1975, a long time ago, I had a course called The Design of Experiments. Hmm. And we had to collect data on any subject and then make statistical conclusions using the mathematical models that were in this textbook. And we worked on an old IBM mainframe computer, which isn't even as powerful as a PC today. And
or your phone, perhaps.
Yeah, or my phone, yes, exactly. And we had to do punch cards and operate in Fortran, four language. And being a golfer, I called the Northern California Golf Association and said, I'm a golfer. I'm a student at the Naval Postgraduate School. Is there anything that could be improved in golf? And they could have blown me off, but the person that helped me was a fellow named Ron Reed, who later worked for the USGA. And he said, yeah, the USGA's course rating system doesn't work. It's just based on yardage. So I said, wow, that's really odd. And so he helped me get on golf courses. On my free time, I collected a lot of shot data, every kind of shot that a golfer would make and what counts as difficult, obstacle difficulty on golf holes. And I created what became the USGA course rating system, which is using obstacle difficulty along with the length. So previously, it had just been length. And then in 1977, Northern Cal had me give a presentation to all their course raters. It was up in San Jose at Alma Den Golf Course. And they all liked it. And they said, and then they turned around and they wrote to the USGA. And they said, USGA, since you don't have a system that's worth anything, we're going to adopt the Knuth course rating system. And so they wrote that letter. And they were in the process of rating our golf courses, coming up with a course rating. 1978, and I graduated from Naval Postgraduate School, and I was sent on an aircraft carrier in the middle of the Mediterranean. And I got a letter from the U.S. Golf Association, and the USGA said, we would like to adopt your course rating system, but we also would like you to become a consultant to us and try to figure out how to make handicaps more portable. You've made ratings better, and we will adopt this, but would you also work on making handicaps portable?
And you were on a ship in the middle of the Pacific at that point?
No, I was in the Atlantic. I was in the Mediterranean.
And you're like, wait a minute, I want to go home.
In the Mediterranean Sea, and I was on an admiral staff, Commander Terry Group 4, on the USS Saratoga. And I went to the admiral, and I said, Admiral, can I be a consultant to the USGA? And he said, well, that's definitely not a conflict of interest. And of course, you know, it's on your own free time. And we were already working 16-hour days, you know, at sea. And so I didn't have much free time, but I worked on it. And when I got back from deployment, I went to a meeting with the USGA, and I said, okay, I think that I can make handicaps portable by creating a bogey rating, being able to add another dimension and rate golf courses for the bogey golfer. And I created a test down in Norfolk, Virginia, where I was through the ship was stationed at the time, and did this major study. I had bogey golfers from all the golf courses around the area, and they all recorded all their hole scores and what was difficult on each hole, and I rated the holes, and I created a bogey rating. Then with the bogey rating, as I explained before, I could create a course rating, excuse me, and then therefore USGA slope rating. And so in 1981, the USGA offered me a position on their staff, the first ever director of handicapping. I went on their staff, and my first job was, number one, it was to teach this system to all the golf associations in America. Travel around. 1982, I went to Colorado. They were the first state to rate their golf courses, and they implemented the system in 1983, and I was busy teaching elsewhere. And then the next year, six states adopted it, course rating and slope rating. The next year, 20 states, and then after that, it just kept going and going. So
amazing story.
Yeah, and then it started going worldwide, and I started teaching the system worldwide, and now it's going to be part of the new world handicap system that's going to come about, where every country in the world is going to use the slope system.
Really?
Yeah.
That's phenomenal. So at any point did anyone in the beginning of this, were these all mathematicians, or did someone pull you aside and say, I don't get it? I mean, is this the easiest way to explain this to the lay person?
Yes, technically. And there was a really, interesting event early on. The RNA, Roland Ancient Golf Club in St. Andrews, and the University of St. Andrews created a world golf symposium. And it was mostly about golf equipment, but it was all pretty much scientists, though, that attended this from universities around the world and from the golf world. And they asked me to give a paper explaining basically a two-dimensional handicap system. So it went from one dimension, when it was just course rating based on yardage, to now two dimensions, where handicaps could vary depending on where you played. And so I gave a major presentation there. And so that's how it pretty much got announced to the world. Yeah. And then I stayed on the USGA staff 16 years. So the next year, we started up the GIN service, Golf Handicapping Information Network, and started calculating handicaps and brought the first distributed system, where scores previously all had to be mailed in and processed and punched in and processed, and created the first IBM PC Juniors, which is a very weak, but it was a small computer, 64K. Used a Raquel Vatic modem phone, which is 300 baud, which is ridiculously slow. And it was the cat's meow of the time, though, because people could post their scores and have them transmitted in to our mainframe network. And now it's gone all beyond that, but started up the first, the first distributed type of way to get in scores without having to write them down somewhere, actually put them in the computer. So pretty much everybody's on that now.
Yeah. And boy, the internet, once again, the high-speed internet has changed everything. Huh?
Yeah, that's for sure. By the minute.
By the minute. Yeah. Phenomenal story. Oh, thank you so much. So let me ask you, from a perspective of someone who worked for the USGA for such a long time, and, advocating for, hopefully advocating for the golfer at that point.
Amateur golfers. That's what I care about.
Yeah. And I always got the sense that they were really protecting the integrity of golf courses, not the golfer.
Yeah.
What would you say to that?
Interesting question.
I always felt like the USGA was an advocate for the golf course. And the golfers, you're just going to have to, you're going to have to make it on your own. Good luck.
Yeah, I don't know if that's kind of a general statement. See, I know certainly from my standpoint that wasn't the case because I always cared about amateur golfers or tried to help amateurs enjoy the game more. Mm-hmm. And, that's always what motivated me was to try to be able to do that. So,
well, we thank you, for that.
When you look at, the concerns about the distance of the golf ball, because I always thought, even though the USGA was concerned about that, I think they were more concerned about it from the standpoint of the pros playing in the U.S. Open. They were concerned that some of the great golf courses that host the U.S. Open would no longer be able to do so because they couldn't make them long enough again. Because when players went from a wound ball to a solid ball, the tour pros, people with high swing speeds, increased their distance by 25 yards. I mean, that's if you look at that. Over a period of time when they all transferred to the solid, especially the three-piece solid ball, the distances went up. But the average golfer didn't go up that much. Average golfers maybe increased their distance 10 yards is all. And so I've never been concerned with the distance of the ball, even though famous people like Jack Nicklaus, constantly talks about how the game is being ruined by the longer ball and the USGA's concern with losing some of these great historic courses, that were great for past US Opens, but might not be in the future unless they move the tees back, or even the Masters. I mean, the Masters has moved its tees back a lot over the years. They just bought some more land. They want to extend the 12th, the great 12th hole. Because they're just buying some land from Augusta Nash or from Augusta Country Club next door. But I've never been concerned really because to me, I've never met an amateur golfer who said that they hit the ball too far. Have you? I've never had.
No.
So therefore I'm not concerned with, distance of the ball. I mean, that's just one aspect of your question.
But, sure.
Yeah.
So how is the state of the, let's say with the state of the industry right now, and that would entail golf courses, golf products?
Well, it's certainly, there were a lot of golf courses being built during a time before the downturn in the economy, up to 2008. And I think at one time there were 400 new golf courses a year. That number is going down. I think that we're finding the right number of golf courses. I mean, some of the clubs shut down or became developments. But I think overall, I think that the game of golf is pretty healthy. I think younger people are concerned that the game takes a lot of time, and certainly pace of play is an issue that needs to be addressed. I developed a pace rating system back when I was on the USGA staff to try to rate the time it should take to play different holes to help clubs monitor and marshal the pace of play better. But pace of play is still an issue, especially young people that might only want to do a sport for an hour. Mm-hmm. But once you get into the game, the game hooks you very quickly. It's wonderful to see a good shot go, right? You don't remember your bad shots usually. If you do remember your bad shots, then you're not going to be a golfer very long. But if you remember your good shots, it keeps you coming back. It's such a great game.
Luckily that good shot is on the 18th hole. Usually,
yes.
Like when you've just given up everything and say, "Forget it already," and you have your one great shot and said, "I'll be back tomorrow."
Right. Yeah. Golf's a great game. So I think that the industry's okay. I mean, what I've seen at I've gone to the PGA merchandise show in Orlando the last 4 years, and I've seen more and more big companies come back, and I've seen more and more people. This year was back up to big numbers again. So I think that just looking at it from that standpoint, I think that people are positive about, you know, the return of the game. I mean, it's TaylorMade, who's been the big guy. They don't fit the model of their parent company. Is it Adidas owns them, and they're looking to sell them. And I guess they've got some bids for them, because they want Adidas. Their model is they want companies that always grow every year. And I think TaylorMade's been up and down in its numbers. And so I think that that's a sell-off, but I don't think that's any kind of sign of the industry going downward. I think other companies are coming back. Callaway's had a good year. They had a very good year last year coming back. So, you know, I think that the industry is good.
And you talked briefly before about how young people today don't necessarily want to spend that much time out there if they're going to be frustrated. What is your sense about the future of the game and growing the game? Are there opportunities that are being fulfilled right now, or are we in trouble?
Okay. Something just happened in the sound. And
I apologize. All right. I'll try to ask that question again. And talking about the future of the game and bringing young people, bringing a new generation to golf. How do you feel about where we are and where we're headed?
Well, can you still hear me okay? Okay. I think the future of the game totally depends on junior golf. Yeah. And I think that junior golf, there's a lot of strong programs. And really, to become a good golfer, you know, the young people that get into junior golf early and they start competing, they're doing great in the game. And, you know, just as an example, our club, my club, San Diego Country Club, is going to host the 2017 United States Women's Amateur Championship. And they had the Curtis Cup players that are going to go play in Ireland in June, came and played like a workout, December 18th and 19th. They did 36 a day. These girls are 17 years old, and they're just playing unbelievable golf. They're just so good at a young age. It's just incredible. And, you know, a couple of them are going to go on to college. Some of them are going to try to turn pro earlier, but the Women's Amateur Championship used to have an average age of 20 or 21. They're now 18. And this year's the eight girls that are playing on the team, I think most of them are 17 or 18 years old. It's incredible. So the junior golf programs really are creating a future growth for the game. And it's all about our young people.
And it's future growth for competitive players. But what about for us, for the amateur player who's not looking to play in club championships, you know, as we age?
Right.
We're just looking for weekend fun. Is there opportunities for growing the game in that direction?
It's, you know, you need to have access for the public. And it's public access. It's really important. And I think every community has access through public golf programs. And I think one of the ways to get into golf is through leagues, company leagues or local leagues or community leagues where people play golf together. And it's a great way to meet people. It's a great way to get into the game where you're not playing with a lot of great golfers, but you're having fun. You know, playing in these league competitions. So I think that it all depends on the community. If they have company leagues or local leagues, you know, town you know, town events. I mean, in the town that I grew up in, everybody on the weekend would go over to this one golf course and everybody's playing. Yeah. And they'd all have a beer afterwards and a hot dog and had a great day.
And you grew up in an era, and I've been talking a lot about this lately, an era when bowling was the family activity, and you could do that 12 Ooh. Months a year
yeah.
on the leagues, and it was really booming in the 50s and yeah. 60s.
Right.
Have you experienced Topgolf yet? Are you aware of them?
I am aware of them. I haven't done it yet, but I think Topgolf. Golf sounds like a lot of fun.
Yeah, I finally got a chance to do it. I was in Austin, Texas recently and went out there for a Friday night. Yeah. And I was so excited to see the energy and how much fun people were having who were clearly not golfers, but they just liked hitting a ball. But made it a social. There were double dates. There were families. It was one of the most exciting things I've seen as far as where the future of golf could go.
Yeah. I did a study once for Callaway, when Ely Callaway was alive, he was a brilliant man, and he wanted to know what would it take to grow the game. And so Ely was, he called me in, had lunch with him. He was terrific. Chuck Yash was his president at the time. Ely was, of course, chairman of the board. He was in charge of everything when he was alive. But he said, what would it take to get people playing more? And so I thought that the answer could possibly lie within driving ranges and getting people at driving ranges, because you can just hit the ball and aim at cans or flags or whatever's out there. But the question is, how do you transfer those people from the driving range to the golf course? And my wife, Suzanne, was actually involved in this project as well. And we actually created focus groups of people that have played golf, but they've never been on a golf course. So they've played golf by hitting balls at a driving range. And what the conclusion from these focus groups, both men and women, was that before I go out on a golf course, I want a guide. I want somebody to guide me. So that Ely Callaway was in the process of creating a guide program where a Callaway teaching staff person would give some lessons to these driving range golfers, teach them a little basics on etiquette on the golf course, and then actually take them out for a round of golf as a way to introduce them and transfer them from being a driving range golfer to on a golf course. Unfortunately, that's when Ely got pancreatic cancer, and then the program didn't go any further. So, but he was always thinking about things like that. And I thought that was really would be a wonderful way to approach getting more people into the game.
But it's never been pursued again.
It's never been pursued again.
Wow. What a shame, because he's clearly onto something, and Topgolf got the message from somewhere. because they've got a lot of people out of the driving range. And the one that I attended, they have two pros on staff full time giving lessons if you want them. And they have leagues.
They have leagues.
So
it'd be fun.
Yeah. Hopefully. So you mentioned you were at the PGA merchandise show the last 4 years. I got to believe that's because you've developed your own type of golf club.
I did.
And tell me where that came from. Were you always a tinkerer, or just like you just had this idea, or you saw the numbers? Where did it come from?
In 1997, I retired from the USGA staff, and I moved to San Diego, and I started working for Northrop Grumman Corporation. And worked in basically an engineering company, their engineering and communications equipment for the military. And I thought that drivers were mostly designed for pros. And you can see that that the drivers are being played by pros, hoping that people will play the driver. But the fact is that the requirements and the needs of amateurs for a driver are quite different than from a pro. Pro has a swing speed averaging 115 miles an hour. Most people don't have that kind of swing speed. And so I thought I could design a driver that would be designed for people that don't have 115 mile an hour swing speed. What do they need? And so, or higher, like in the case of Bubba Watson. And so my wife encouraged me. 2002, I developed my first high heat driver and it did really well, but I had no marketing money. And so I got five patents for my technology, which is all expensive process, but I managed to sell the drivers. And then I was finished with it pretty much in 2007. A couple of years later, I met my business partner, Steve Trattner, over some other kind of meeting. I think maybe it was his wedding and went back to Washington, D.C. And he had been a very good intellectual property attorney. And he had been the USJ's intellectual property attorney as one of his clients. He worked out of Washington, D.C. And he also represented Pebble Beach Corporation, Hilton Head, Pinehurst, a lot of golf customers or clients. And he said, you know, I like your vision to help amateur golfers. And so what if we partnered on this and I would put up the money for doing all the research and development that you wanted to do and all, you know, all the testing and the marketing and the development. And I said, and we'll be equal partners. And I said, I think we can do that. So starting now, it's been over 3 years ago, I started design on an even better high heat driver. And I did it. And so he and I, a year ago, January, at that PGA show, went to the demo day and we won from Sports Illustrated. Gary Van Sickle is the writer, very well known for golf.com, and Sports Illustrated named us as the best technology of the show. And then this year, January, Then the International Network of Golf, which is 600 media and industry, we won at this year the best product ingenuity award at the in of anything. And that's not just clubs, but we won that for an emerging company, which was their big award.
That's
and
phenomenal.
So it was just really exciting. And this year also, we came out with our three wood and our first fairway, the three wood, and then the three hybrid. And so we did that and it was just, we won again, we won several awards. We won Tony Leodora's from Philadelphia News, his best driver and three wood award. We want Gary Van Sickle named this as the best three wood in hybrid. He said it was best of breed. And he also called the three wood as it has the sleek lines of a 58 Corvette.
I loved that line. I actually isolated that line as well. It's like, yeah, that is quite the compliment to say your golf club looks like a 58 Corvette.
Yeah.
But he also had a great I loved his line, the most significant technological innovation in golf equipment from this year's PGA merchandise show, and therefore arguably the most exciting new club in a year that lacked dramatic innovations.
Yeah.
So you don't have the R&D money available to you that TaylorMade does, or Adidas or Callaway or anybody else. How come you figured this out and they didn't?
Well, here's the thing. The drivers on the market in the fairways, they're designed again for pros. And so generally the center of gravity is too far forward and too far up for amateurs. Amateurs need to have a deep and low center of gravity, because if your swing speed isn't 115 miles an hour, to get a good launch with a low spin rate, you need a deep and low CG. And the other things that happen with deep and low center of gravity is that your moment of inertia increases, which makes the club more stable and resistant to twisting. And also you allow gear effect to work so that off-center hits actually can come back to center. Whereas when the center of gravity is forward and up, a toe hit is going to go right and stay right, and so on. So off, it's not as forgiving. So this is the big thing that I decided that that amateurs needed. And the second thing that amateurs need is to have a forgiving face, so that they get it anywhere on the face. All of the major brands have a small sweet spot right in the center, and if you hit it off center, you lose distance. But what I've done on the face is I have 7 layers of thinness all over the face so that it's at the USJ's maximum trampoline effect, the CT, the connect time, for over the entire face. So you can hit it anywhere on the face and not lose distance. And that's very important because amateurs don't hit it on the center of the face every time.
Right.
And then the third thing is that all the clubs on the market are all adjustable. And I don't know why. Very few people even adjust. Right. Even if they do, they do it one time. And the problem is that it moves about 20 grams in the wrong direction because the adjustability part in the hosel weighs about 20 grams more than it should have to. But to have adjustability, you're moving that weight now towards the hosel and up, which is, again, the wrong direction. It needs to be back and down. So those are the changes. And then the fourth thing that I did is I wanted to have golfers have immediate feedback on where they hit it on the face. And so I made the face mirror finished so that you get immediate feedback. Every time you hit the ball, you can look at the face and you can get instant feedback on where you hit it on the face.
Oh, wow.
So you can, and then you rub it off before your next hit so that, you know, otherwise you can go out and when you're practicing and put tape on the face, but this is all the time. You always get the feedback. Say, wow, where did I hit that? And you can get the feedback because you want to try to be hitting it, you know, somewhere around the center if you can. And that, that can help you do that. So those are the major things that I did in coming out with something for amateur golfers. It took years to get to that point and a lot of research and development. We wanted to make sure that it went farther than major brands, and it also that it had better dispersion. So off-center hits on the robot, you can actually measure what the dispersion is, and this is almost half the dispersion of a major brand. So
that's amazing.
It's very straight. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So. I frequently have spoken to club makers, custom club makers, club fitters, so many of them have talked about the off-the-rack drivers that are being sold, the shafts are too long for the amateur golfer.
Yeah.
Did you address that as well?
Yes, I do. Ken, a couple of the brands, and I won't say the name of the brand, but they went to 46.5 and 47-inch because it made that driver or club longer than the previous year's club. And then they could advertise 17 yards longer. And that's
longer physically holding it or longer in distance when you hit. But
well,
that's from a machine.
You know, you do gain distance by having the club longer.
Not necessarily straight.
But exactly. It's much harder to be square to impact. I mean, there are a lot of tour pros even who are playing 45 inches or 44¾-inch drivers. And yet these companies were selling, some of them still are, 46.5, 47 inches. They even will say that it's 46 inches, but when you measure it, it's actually 46¾ inches. But that makes it relatively longer. So it just makes it harder to hit it straight, harder to get it in the fairway or keep it in the fairway. So I've made the driver 45 and 45 and a half inches. And for ladies, make it a little bit shorter than that, typically 44 and a half inches. And that helps in control, but you still get a lot of distance because of the very hot face with the seven layers of thinness on the face.
The other thing we talk a lot about is getting fitted for your golf clubs before you make a purchase. And that I know that when I went through my fitting, I tried five or six of the big name brand drivers and ended up with one that it was amazing to me, but I really did hit it differently than all the other clubs.
Yeah.
And how does your club fit in that? You don't customize your club for each customer, do you?
We do. Actually, what we do, we don't have the staff right now to do other than sell online.
Okay.
And so Steve Trattner, my partner, actually personally fits every golfer by email or by phone call. And he has a list of questions that look ominous, but it gets to what you should be playing, what your fitting should be. And so I'll tell you, I don't, you know, just because we're so sure that this is a good, our equipment is good, really good, that we offer 30-day money-back guarantee, no questions asked. And you can play it for 30 days as long as you don't scrape it all up and scratch it, you know, on the crown and, you know, make it impossible to resell as a used club. This is, I think, is an amazing offer. And we do it because we believe people notice the difference right away, which they do. And by having that procedure with Steve fitting them, we have less than 10% return. And I can tell you, major brands get more than 10% return even with a fitting, either through, you know, the stores, Evan Watts or Golf Mart or PGA Superstore, people are coming and trading out. The numbers are much higher than 10% of trading out. And, you know, we have less than 10% return.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
That's amazing. So how many clubs are you offering right now?
The driver. And the driver is in 9.5 degrees, 10.5 degrees, and 12 degrees with mostly Fujikura shafts, although in of different weights. We've got 53 gram, 63 gram, 73 gram Fujikura Pro, excellent high-end shaft by a well-known brand. And we also offer for senior golfers and for ladies the Sakura Fujikura shaft. Sakura is very flexible and gives you a kick where it gives you lots of extra roll. And then we also offer the Alvila Magnum 44 senior flex shaft. And the Magnum 44 is 44 grams. It's a super, super light shaft. And so that's what we offer in the driver, 9.5, 10.5, and 12 degree. And then our 3-wood is a 15 degree loft. It comes in our normal cobalt blue painted, or it comes in an unpainted version that's been blasted with glass beads. It's kind of a cool, sexy look. And we call that nude. And you usually put in the same shaft as what you'd have on your driver in the 3-wood. And so we just ask you to select that. And then the other club is the 3 hybrid, which is a 19 degree loft. And typically you go up 10 grams from whatever, usually hybrids are 10 grams, shaft is heavier, 10 grams by compared to your 3-wood. So a little heavier. The really important thing about our 3-wood and our hybrid is that 99% of all the brands have steel heads. All the major brands are steel head. I've developed a way to put a titanium face. It's a cup face, a titanium face with my 7 zones of thinness onto a steel body. And you can't weld those two metals together. But what you can do is you can braze them together with silver. Very expensive process. But we've had my manufacturer hit them 10,000 times and does not come apart. It stands up over 10,000 hits. And so you get a hot face on it with the steel body and the deep and low center of gravity. So it is the hottest face of any three wood and hybrid. And we've tested that.
Wow. Congratulations. Are you pricing competitively or where do your price points stand?
Yeah. I think it's pretty standard pricing that our full retail price for the driver is $399. It's $299 for the three wood. We'd like to offer that at a lower price. The cost of making the head with the titanium face is about twice what the major manufacturers have to spend. And then it's $249 for the hybrid. So that's the retail price. And there are a few deals going around once in a while. We're going to be offering our clubs on Amazon. And so I think with Amazon, you're going to probably get a little bit of a deal.
Awesome. Well, this has been phenomenal information. Yeah. Thank you so much for your time and the explanation of rating slope and the introduction of the high heat clubs. An education in just an hour. That's pretty impressive.
Thank you very much.
Well, having 100% money back guarantee is pretty awesome when you're trying out a new driver. But I just spoke to Dean's partner and got an exclusive offer for Golf Smarter listeners. Go to knuthgolf.com. That's K-N-U-T-H. Knuth Golf. Order the high heat driver. And when you're checking out, they'll want to know how you heard about it. Just enter Golf Smarter and you'll get $70 off the price. So instead of paying $399, you're only paying $329 for a brand new driver that if you don't like, send it right back and you'll get all your money back. That's not bad. Well, I don't think it is. So please take advantage of this great offer as soon as you possibly can. Now, last year, before each of the majors, we had a couple of guys on the show who made their living by betting on the PGA Tour. Unfortunately, they're not available anymore. But before I pursue someone else, I'd like to know whether you enjoyed that topic, if you got something out of it, or even if you made some money, or if you just don't care. So let me know soon, because if we do go after this, I need to get somebody on before the Masters, which is just a few weeks away. Just let me know by clicking on the Hey Fred button at golfsmarter.com.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here.
We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.